Hi, this is Xander Cannon. I'm going to be doing a commentary podcast for Top 10 Season 2. This is Issue 1, and I just wanted to sort of quick have a little preamble before I get into the first page. This is a podcast that will sort of cover a lot of things about Top 10, but one thing that won't cover is sort of an exhaustive list of all the references inside the book for two reasons. The reason number one is we sort of do that at the tolerance of the DC legal department, and they don't sort of like to hear that there's some character from a competing company or even from their own company in the background. And so I'll say right now that there isn't. the other reason is I actually wouldn't really even know them all. I may make suggestions and and say, hey, Gene, why don't you put this in here? But Gene Ha, the artist, may very well, he may put them in, he may ignore them, he may come up with something far better, and does in many cases. And in a lot of cases about that, it's like, I don't even know who that is, or I would have to be reminded. Or in a lot of cases, because of wanting to make these parodies and things that are sort of not only legal but ethical, we've changed the coloring and make things sort of recognizable as like, haha, wink, wink, you know, yes, we're all on the same side. We know that this is such and such a character, even though he's a parody version. He's a different color. He's mashed up with another character and so forth. In any case, I may mention some that are particularly A, clever, or B, public domain. But generally, this podcast will be about sort of the process of creating a comic, and particularly creating a comic that is where you're doing the writing and essentially the art. I mean, no, this actually sounds very disrespectful to Gene, but of course, he did the art, and it is absolutely his vision in terms of the aesthetic. What I did is a layout, which is a very rough version of the story. If you were to look at the layouts, you would think, okay, I can read this as a comic, and I can sort of understand where it's going. But it doesn't have, for one thing, the architecture. For another thing, the richness of the details and that sort of thing. It's very rough and very sort of more like proof of concept, so that you can really sort of get the gist of it. But it's not, the experience that the final reader has. You know, that the person who buys the comic book on the rack will have. The reason I did this this way is one. I've been doing the layouts since the very beginning. A little history. Obviously, Alan Moore and Gene Ha created Top 10. I came in about a third of the way through the first issue and started doing layouts for Gene. Gene really enjoys doing detailed work and architecture, perspective, anatomy, that sort of stuff. But the process of storytelling, while he is perfectly good at it, it slows him down a fair amount, and he couldn't keep it to his schedule. And so I came on to sort of do rough layouts, basically what I've just been talking about, so that we could speed him up and keep the book on track. so the reason to do these layouts this way, especially for me coming on as a writer, is that Alan Moore is a tough act to follow, as people have pointed out to me. And I think that in this case it was a very good idea to say, all right, this is what it's going to look like. Reading a comic book script and knowing what the comic book is going to be like, it takes some practice, but also it's like everybody's going to see it differently in their mind. But if I could sort of show people, this is a comic book that you can read, this is something that that you know how it's actually going to flow and where the beats are, that's going to help people sort of be enthusiastic about this book before it comes out. And this book had a particularly long lead time. Gene had other obligations before this book could come out, and so these scripts and layouts sat around for quite some time until he got to them. Now the this podcast is going to sort of go through the book sort of scene by scene. I'll try to sort of keep the page flipping to a minimum. I'm going to be looking at both the layouts and the final book. The final book, because of course that's the experience that everybody else has had, but the rough layouts, because, well, that's the experience that I had. I sort of looked at those pages a lot, and those will sort of evoke more memories for me when we go through. So when we started this book, just had begun a business called Big Time Attic, and so my partners, Shad Petoskey and Kevin Cannon, sort of, we all sat down and started brainstorming. And so I really want to give credit where credit is due. Kevin sort of helped a lot with sort of plotting and things like that. Shad came up with a great number of extremely important ideas. He came up with the character of Slipstream Phoenix, especially sort of pointing out that, excuse me, he was a sort of a scrubbed clean super cop, and some of his more sort of supernatural elements, which actually haven't been revealed yet, and as well as the wizard character and premise keepers. He came up with other ones too. I can't think of them right off the bat, but I'll probably mention them as I go through. So. So big shout out to Shad for some excellent ideas and a sort of an extraordinarily keen sense for what makes the top 10 aesthetic of here's sort of the ordinary mundane lives of people superimposed over 70 years of superhero comics. As I started page one, I did several versions of this page. Because I wanted to, well, first I started writing scripts, and then I started writing, sort of plots, that didn't really have any dialogue. And I thought, well, I'll sort of fill that in later. Finally, the pressure of following Alan Moore was so suffocating that I sort of thought, you know, I had to sort of think to myself, you know what? I've been doing layouts this entire time. I need to not think of it as a writing project. I need to think of it as a layout project and basically retrofit writing into it, and think more about the flow of the story and think more about the experience that the reader has looking at the page, and then put in writing, and then put in the writing instead of thinking of it words first, then pictures. And what came out of that is basically writing this book right here on the page. The experience that you have reading the first panel, well, that's the experience that I had writing the first panel. I came up with the size of the panel, and I figured out what's going to be in it, and the captions and the word balloons, it's like I placed them in the order that I sort of was reading them on the page. It's very much a spatial process rather than what comic book scripting typically is, which is calling for an image and then calling for the words to be in that image, but leaving it to others to sort of determine exactly what order you're going to read all the words and the pictures. It sounds very control freakish, and it possibly is, but. That's what this project, I think, requires. Other projects do not, and I hope that I would not necessarily operate in that way on other projects. In any case, the first scene here, I wanted to sort of introduce this new character. I also wanted to sort of introduce sort of the dullness, the mundaneness of the world. And also, there's a bit of a hint here where, you know, the pool. I feel like you can establish things with pictures, but you always as a writer, you always kind of need to, if you want something to be important, you kind of need to run it into the dialogue. So I wanted to mention this pool in front of the the police precinct, and because if we don't, well, then all of a sudden people showing up, dead people showing up in a pool doesn't have the same ring to it, because you never know how the art is really going to turn out, and it might not have the proper focus. So if we have this character, instead of just saying, oh, there's a pool there, we want to have it be disguised as something else. Okay, well, it's a way for us to show that this new guy, Slipstream Phoenix, is a stickler for rules. Also, I wanted to make sure that we got a good close-up of him on the first page, because, you know, if the only close-ups are these sort of teenage thugs, we're basically supposed to be kind of sidekick, 90s tough guy style sidekicks, then it just would seem, well, it just doesn't seem like it's the right book. So I wanted to make sure that I ended the page with a good close-up of Slipstream Phoenix. He's this new character. He's obviously a cop. He's got a hat. He's got the uniform. He's got a badge, and he's, you know, giving these guys a hard time. When I went into these next couple pages, I really wanted to pack in a lot of information, because I knew that on the turn for the fourth page is when we're going to have a big reveal. So I feel like you're kind of safe in the first three pages to sort of say, all right, you know, we don't have to have a big splashy image on these pages. We can have it be really sort of down and dirty, lots of little, basically one-ninth of the page panels. You know, we have these wide shots, of course, which are nice because they sort of break it up. They allow us to sort of switch people's positions and things like that. You'll notice that in the first panel, we really establish everyone's positions. Okay, well, he's at the top of the steps. He's pointing down at these guys. And they're on his, you know, they're mad at him or whatever. And we can see that, oh, there's a whole bunch of people coming in and out of the precinct house. Well, now in these next six panels, we're less concerned with people's relative position here, and we're more concerned with emotions, interpersonal conflicts, or interpersonal sort of relationships. You know, of course, I really make sure that everyone sort of keeps on the same side of their 180-degree line. There is one little switch here in this panel, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, where, you know, we sort of pull back, show that Phoenix is going over to the desk, pull back, and we sort of see him and Hector, and we see him and we see Dwayne, and we see Pete entering the scene. It's good, I think, to sort of, you know, you have these small panels dealing with people's faces, people's emotions. You know, it's less important about where they are, and more important that we just instantly recognize them and that they're and see what they're thinking. After that, we have this bottom panel, and it's like, okay, now we can pull back. We can reestablish where everyone is because they're leaving that space. So we can sort of say, okay, let's, you know, in my layouts, I really just sort of said, okay, well, here's the guy with a police hat and a cape. Here's the guy with the little earphones. That's Pete. And then here's the guy with the cowboy hat. That's Dwayne. We can pull back, and we can sort of reestablish where everyone is in relation to each other. The next page, same sort of thing. We got these wide panels that really sort of establish where people are, and then we have these close-up panels which start showing people's emotions. Panel two is, well, here's Slipstream Phoenix, first time in the precinct house. He's really looking around. We got little guys in the background that look like weirdos, aliens, and whatnot. And then, of course, we have a little plot point. He sees the guy, Deadeye Davis, this file clerk, using his X-ray vision to see through the files. And of course, it's nice to. And this is another thing: when you're doing things as layouts, you can sort of say like, "Oh, so what's he say?" The character says, "Nothing big yet." I figure he's waiting for the big briefing, but it's all talk of normalcy quotation marks. Well, in that same panel, of course, we have a guy using X-ray vision to look through files. It's nice to sort of have that sort of juxtaposition there. you know, same again. We have this wide panel here, less about people's relative positions, but it's like, you know, a good survey of like, okay, here's Dwayne's face, here's Pete's face, here's Slipstream Phoenix's face. And of course, you can have a little bit more time because people will have to read all the way across the panel. You know, we have the character speaking from inside the captain's office, the response from Pete, and then suddenly Slipstream notices, here's something. And of course, that all takes almost a minute. But it's all this single image. That's the magic of comics. Then again, now we have these three quick little panels, trying to quickly get Slipstream out of the room and across the lobby, so that he can then have this big opening thing where we see here's that big reveal of the page, all the dead bodies. And here's something funny. You know, when I drew this, of course, I'm just drawing these sort of blobs in the thing there, and of course you sort of indicate, oh yes, they're women, they're dead, they're naked, but it doesn't seem very shocking. But then of course you ask Gene Ha to draw, and of course Gene Ha draws things much more realistically. Well, then you suddenly have the problem that, oh, it's a whole bunch of naked, you know, dead women in the pond. And this comic, while it's not code approved or whatever things are anymore, it's still supposed to be, you know, all ages to some degree. Certainly not gruesome or pornographic. It's supposed to be gruesome, but it's not supposed to be sort of in-your-face, shocking visually. I think that they had to do some editing. Look at the comic here. They had some blowing papers across sort of obscuring key parts, which I think that Gene actually made a little comment on that. One of the pages says "fight censorship," and of course I think, okay, fair enough. But I also think that it's certainly fair enough for them to ask for that. You needed the book to be what the book is, which is to say it needs to be sort of all ages. So anyway, this turn on the fourth page, you know, it's the thing that Top Ten did a lot. It's the thing that Alan Moore does a lot. It's the thing that I sort of felt like was an important Top Ten thing, but that we have the big turn, the reveal, the name of the story, and then quickly back to small panels, character stuff, moving on and on, and then of course another Top Ten thing where we have the captain say something iconic that moves us to another scene and means something different in that scene. You know, he says, Pete says, what for? Sir, just call the meat wagon. They're all dead. You stole that kind of talk, Officer Cheney. Each one of these people is somebody's baby. And of course, then we switch to the next scene where, she's now, it's Officer Peregrine, Lieutenant Peregrine, and she's looking at, a very Top Ten like, pregnancy test.
All right. The scene is, Peregrine looking at her pregnancy test. That was definitely Gene's inclusion, to have the pregnancy test look like the ultimate nullifier. I think it was from Fantastic Four. Now, of course, it may not be. He says as he covers his bases. But anyway, I just drew it as a regular looking pregnancy test. But then it had that pink shield logo in there. Just to be funny, and to make it in the world of Top Ten. One of the things that was actually in the script and in the layouts, but for whatever reason didn't get worked in, was that the next couple panels, the one where she says Lloyd, and she's walking into the hallway, and all this stuff, all these had little magazines, like all those pictures on the wall were actually meant to be framed magazines, Neapolitan Weekend magazine, and sort of a feature on them, and the one on the right-hand side of that panel 4 was supposed to be a magazine called Custodias, and it was written on the spine. So, which of course Custodias, translated loosely, means watchman, and it was going to be shown the way that it was. The logo was going to be the way that Watchmen is on the Watchmen comics, you know. And it was talking about Top Flight, and it kept mentioning Top Flight, Top Flight, Top Flight, which is her husband's name. There's going to be like magazine called SDH, Sharp Dressed Hero. And anyway, Science Hero Informer, Them Weekly instead of Us Weekly, and blah, blah, blah. All as she's, you know, leading into this room, you know, it's like we're setting up this thing. It's all these very boring panels that, you know, have some information in them, but really they're pretty boring panels. And then on the page turn, it's like, oh, no, it's like he's not who he's supposed to be. He's not, you know, he's not Top Flight. He's the Green Bolt. And this is another funny thing. It's like, this is something that's very, that's a relatively recent thing is, you know, up until, oh, I don't know, 10 years ago, almost all comics were lettered right there on the original boards. And for a number of reasons, that is not the case with Top 10. But, of course, if that's why the character named the Green Bolt is in red. If that word balloon were right there, I can guarantee you he wouldn't be. But the colorists don't get the lettering files, or very rarely do, and so they're just working on off of the artwork in a certain way out of context. So it's kind of a funny thing, and of course no one caught it until too late, and so there it is. And so really it just is something very silly where it's like, oh, he's called the Green Bolt, yet he's wearing a red costume. That's pretty bizarre. This whole scene, of course, is meant to be like, oh, you got this very ordinary husband, you got this very ordinary wife. They've been together forever, and they're very successful and all that stuff. And yet, he's got this secret obsession with, in this case, crossover dressing. Instead of dressing up like a woman, he dresses up like a different superhero. Instead of being Top Flight, he's the Green Bolt. And of course, it doesn't seem all that upsetting, so I tried to really play up Peregrine's reaction and make her say, oh, I feel sick, I have to go to work, I'm really upset, so that we can really kind of understand. There's a lot of subtle... It's a subtle scene. That sounds like I'm blowing my own horn. It's actually a pretty dumb scene, but all the little things that are supposed to catch on are a little bit subtle, and it's a little bit tricky. So if it escaped you, I can hardly blame you. In fact, I would blame myself. And then, of course, we have the bridge dialogue, which I probably did between every single scene in this, because it's very useful, and it also sort of it just makes you realize, okay, you're not missing anything. This is the way it flows. Sometimes if you like just turn a page and there's no connection between the scenes, you kind of think like, oh wait, am I supposed to know something that I don't know, or what? And that's when I wanted to go into the classic Hill Street Blues, you know, the classic sort of briefing scene. Okay, here's the captain, and he's going to say, all right, everybody, you be careful out there, and all that stuff. Similarly, I wanted to give us a bunch of information here. For the next, you know, in issue two, I wanted to sort of reintroduce a clone of girl two, or girl one rather, and so I wanted to really say, okay, let's remind everyone of Mickey Millions, and let's also say, he's not such a great guy because he did, you know, he's basically doing insider trading, and let's also remind people, oh yes, remember our dear friend, the late Girl One, and then show her, and then show Irma, her partner, and remind everyone how sad that made her, and that sort of stuff. Or angry, I guess. She looks angry in that picture. And then, of course, we have all right, you know, let's set up a couple of other things, dealing to kids, so on and so forth. But the main thing was, all right, here we go. David Moon Gilbert is the new commissioner. That might sound like a pretty ordinary, boring name. I guess the idea behind him comes from a character called Diana Moon Glampers, who was the Equalizer General, or Chief Equalizer, or something Equalizer, something or other, in I believe a Kurt Vonnegut story called Harrison Bergeron. Basically, I wanted him to be this force for, equality and for basically for all science fiction dystopias. You know, that there would be elements from Brave New World, elements from 1984, elements from Harrison Bergeron, V for Vendetta, Logan's Run, etc., 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 etc. I like that Top Ten remains sort of like a rooted in like American pop culture superhero stuff. I've always really liked sort of, well, let's bring in bits of magic and let's bring in bits of science fiction, but those sort of need to be pushed off to the side so that we can have the superheroes take the center stage. And this was a really useful way to sort of be able to have almost entirely off-panel these references to the science fiction dystopias by really just having him speak to them and make references to all the things that they do there. Just sort of a convenient place to stick all those ideas. And then we have Pete and Dwayne sort of saying talking about how boring he is. Oh, he's this boring. He's boring, 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 boring. Just to remind everyone. Oh, yes, this guy is tremendously boring. You know. And then he comes in and he's basically a holographic head in a robot suit. Gene, I think, drew initially. I think I drew him so that his head was on a screen, basically just a video screen. Gene changed it so that it's like a holographic bubble, and also I think he wanted it to be like 1984, where this character is always staring at you, so that no matter where you move, it's like he's always looking directly at you. And it was also nice because he only had to draw the guy once, and then he could just superimpose it every single time. Don't tell him that I pointed that out. Here you go. On page 9, you know, we start here. Here he comes, and he starts sort of saying like, "All right, everyone, I'm here in this mechanical man. I hate it. In fact, I hate everything that's flamboyant or interesting. Basically, I hate everything that Top Ten stands for. And so, I'm going to have everybody have to wear uniforms. And then, bang, we reintroduce Slipstream Phoenix. We've basically introduced him as a pretty good character. Very, you know, sort of forthright, friendly, blah blah. But then it's like, oh, wait a second. All of a sudden, he's not so great. He's a spy, or he seems to be a spy, or he's a sort of an agent of this almost entirely unlikable commissioner character. Then move on to with our bridging dialogue again, effective immediately. I don't know why. It just was at that point. I was just like, yeah. Peregrine's effective immediately. One of the things that I like to do in my layouts, and it's not entirely in the final thing, is that I really like to do very formal layouts, very symmetrical layouts, especially for big opening scenes. I find that it really slows the eye down. When you have asymmetrical things, it usually implies action and movement. Whereas there's something I kind of liked, in fact, this early scene is Peregrine sort of gliding in, and the fact that, for me, the fact that she was that it was symmetrical almost made her kind of hang in midair. She was moving in very slowly, and we could sort of then go look down and go, oh yes, okay, here's the ambulance, here's all the dead people, here are all the buildings and roads and stuff like that beyond the precinct. And then we're here setting up Multi-Woman. She had a few cameos. I think she even did some interesting stuff in the first series, but mainly she was supposed to be. But she was mainly a background character, definitely second tier character. And I wanted to really sort of say like, you know, again like all these other characters, she's gonna start being a more interesting character. And so let's really set her up. And also, she's kind of useful too, because she makes smart aleck comments and doesn't suffer fools gladly. So she's always very useful to have around. And then, of course, we can have all this this police talk. You know, who are the victims, blah, blah, blah. You know, nobody saw anything, et cetera. They've started a file. And then we show that Peregrine, even if she's sort of feeling like her world is falling apart, she can still pull it all together. And then when she sees her friend, Jackie Kowalski, she can just say, let me just dump everything on you. Here on the next page, we start seeing the aftermath of finding out that Slipstream Phoenix is kind of people don't like him anymore, and everybody's sort of, you know, talking about him or shushing each other up when they say, oh, here he comes, and et cetera. And he walks outside, and then we sort of realize, oh, okay, this is why we're setting up Jenny McCambridge, multi-woman. He's her partner. And then, of course, we get the big joke. Which one of you is Jenny McCambridge? And we just say, all right, just in case you weren't paying attention before, this woman has seven iterations of herself. And so, which one of you is Jenny McCambridge? I am, et cetera, et cetera. More police talk. It's nice. And then it's sort of nice to sort of take this character who, is always sort of a smart aleck and always sort of is kind of in your face. Give her a moment where she sort of looks at someone that she thinks is kind of attractive and go, oh, yeah, here's a nice new guy. Funny thing is, in my layouts, Slipstream Phoenix is intended to be much more sort of handsome, leading man-esque. I think Gene actually modeled him after some actor who's kind of schlumpy, but, you know, not terrible looking, but it's kind of funny that it's like, oh wow, check this guy out, and he's just kind of this schlumpy looking guy. I just noticed there in the background that I did not put this in, but Gene put in the Chainsaw Vigilante from The Tick, which was the first comic that I ever worked on. Setting up a little thing with Irma. Irma becomes very much of a main character there. One of the things that Gene always said is that if he could ever do Top Ten again, or if he could ever start Top Ten again, he would redesign Irmageddon because she's such a pain in the neck to draw, because she's got all this gadgetry all over her uniform, and I guess it's just a pain in the neck to draw. I mean, I just sort of blop down, you know, oh, this is circles and squares and rectangles, and I don't really care. But of course, Gene has to put in every little piece of circuitry and stuff like that. So this was putting her in a uniform and having her be all upset about it was a little bit of a gift to him, which is like, okay, here you go. So she's wearing the same uniform as everybody else. Enjoy. We're setting up more stuff, bringing out Deadeye, talking with Slipstream Phoenix, talking with Multi-Woman, and setting up his eyes and setting up the fact that, oh, he doesn't feel appreciated, you know, let's, maybe if he helps, it'll help everything for him. Moving on to the next thing, of course, here, the bridge dialogue, just put a couple pieces of the puzzle together. With this next couple scene, I wanted to introduce sort of a subset of the city, two subsets of the city. One was that there are these sort of roving gangs of newsboys, sort of like the Newsboy Legion and all of the stuff that Jack Kirby created based on his boyhood in whenever he was growing up, the 20s or 30s or something like that. I kind of like the idea that we wouldn't really ever show it too much, but I like that we could always sort of make reference to these newsboys, you know, as they're sort of the ambitious types or whatever. We move into this part of town where there's like 1,000 newsboys outside. They're all yelling extra, 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 read all about it. One of my favorite little gags was in this first panel of page 16, where they say, well, what do they say, what kind of drugs they were? Nah, probably goose juice, which is established in Top Ten, but sub-marijuana is my addition. I thought that was pretty funny. Then the sort of thing was you know, Dwayne usually carries this, you know, enormous 12-shooter gun. It's gold and stuff like that. And he's getting all worked up about how people are dealing to kids, and he wants to pull out the gun and sort of show that he means business. But, well, in the layouts, I actually had him pull out, like, the sort of snub-nosed 38. It's a really sort of, by comparison, very wimpy-looking gun. Here it's more of a, you know, like a 45 automatic, but even so, it looks smaller, if you remember what kind of gun he carried. This next scene when they were, you know, I wanted to have a little bit of conversation about, like, the weapons policy and so on and so forth, and give a very small sort of half-baked explanation for Pete's powers, and that his family still was struck by ball lightning. I don't know why that's funny, but it just kind of like two very sort of country things. One, that they would have a still in the first place, and then two, that ball lightning, that's always seems to be the thing that people mistake for UFOs. This next scene was meant to sort of be like, okay, well, let's find this newsboy, and then he's talking. They're sort of shaking him down, or, you know, doing sort of the good cop bad cop stuff. In fact, Chad Potosky wanted when we were talking about this, we were wanting the scene to be a little bit longer, where they would really start kind of getting to say things, talk himself into a corner, that sort of thing. It was a much longer scene as it was originally imagined, but it was really starting to screw with the pacing of the thing. And so when I ended up actually writing it, it was a much more streamlined thing. I just wanted to have it be on one page, and then have the reveal at the end of the page have this page go to all the way down to the bottom, have the big explosion, and then the reveal. So yeah, he says Zotok, and then this next page 18, I actually have on my wall. It's really kind of funny actually to look at these two, to look at the layouts, and then look at the final artwork next to each other, because there's no competition. I mean, the layouts are so, they're all right, but it's just a character that kind of looks like Shazam, kind of looks like Black Adam maybe. From DC, but Gene drew this like 10-foot-tall guy with a mohawk and this crazy Mayan design on his chest, and he's got lightning bolts sparking from him to the wall, and there's clouds of dust, and it's just amazing what he does. Whereas mine's just kind of like, oh, here's a guy. He kind of looks scary and big, but that's about it. Gene gave that piece of original artwork for that page to my son as a birthday present, so that was really nice. We have it in our house. Again, the bridging dialogue. I wanted Peregrine to sort of have a moment where we sort of are reminded of the relationship between her and Jackie Phantom. That she's a Christian. She's sort of very turned off by things that are weird or out of the ordinary, and then Jackie Phantom is a little bit more of a sort of more accepting of that sort of thing, and not to mention she's a lesbian, and I think that it was established in the earlier books that she has a bit of a crush on her extremely straight, extremely square partner, and so I wanted to have a moment of ambiguity. Not because I really had planned anything about it. I just sort of thought, well, let's just give them a moment where it's like we show how much they care about each other as friends, but then also sort of have this sort of uncomfortable moment of what does this mean? She's so upset, and here's this extremely accepting, sympathetic person right there for her. And of course, nothing has come of it, but I just wanted to have that moment. And then we have Charon, who is a useful character the same way Pete Chaney is. He's very, he says all horrible things. What does he say? We've got our delivery meat lovers hold the sausage, as in a whole bunch of dead people, but they're all girls. But of course, he's never around. I mean, he's only in this one room, and so We have to, and people have to walk in for him to say anything obnoxious. We have more plot stuff, let's further develop the characters of Jenny McCambridge and Slipstream Phoenix. Then we also set up one of the main plot things very, very subtly, which is that who's this guy with the eyes? And Slipstream Phoenix almost says his name, but then he's kind of interrupted by his partner, and then they never really actually get to say who it was. So he never gets credit, and so he eventually gets angry and quits. It should probably, for the story purposes, it should have been a little bit more intentional, or sort of a real slip of the, or a real sort of thing that slipstream Phoenix's mind. But the way it worked out, I think, is just fine. These last two scenes here, we've just come off of Slipstream Phoenix and Multi Woman sort of becoming a little bit more friendly, sort of respecting each other's skills, basically making friends. And being great partners together, and then we sort of go to the person who's lost her partners, who's lost her partner. We sort of have seen Irma sort of being kind of upset about this whole thing. She's got they're taking away all her weapons, they're taking away her armor, she's lost her best friend and her partner. She just needs to talk to someone, sort of get it all straightened out. So we want to, Mickey Millions, who we established at the beginning of this of the issue, and sort of said, okay, here he is. He's waiting in jail, et cetera, et cetera. Even at the bottom of the page, we have him talking about missing the crucial stages of Professor Radium's work right now. Well, that does turn out to be Girl 2. Basically, they're maturing her into adulthood. And, of course, that's even a plot point that will be further down the line. About sort of what they did as a process to sort of make her into a person. I remember thinking of this scene as I was going on a run, talking to each of these people who really don't understand this third person. They don't really understand her because she's sort of an artificial human being. And, from the one point, there's a guy who's like, oh, he can kind of spout all the jargon, but he doesn't really understand her. And then on the other end, Irma's saying, trying to talk about her as a real person, and she really doesn't know what she's saying either. It's just both of them sort of like edging their way around the actual thing. But of course, the main thing is Irma is really sort of lost in the wilderness at this point, and really needs to sort of grab onto something. And this is sort of a theme for her throughout these all these issues, and of course Mickey Millions is no help because he's kind of this selfish, not very sympathetic character, and then of course our dialogue that sort of crosses over or holds over is talking about returning favors, and of course Deadeye Davis wonders if Slipstream Phoenix has sort of let them know. Let the powers that be know that he helped them out, and maybe sort of improving his chances for a raise or for a better posting or something like that. And this is sort of the first instance where we see Slipstream Phoenix kind of lying, or being anything other than just sort of like the regular old good guy. From a personality standpoint, I just sort of thought, how many of us have been put in that situation where it's like, oh man, I forgot to do that thing. I should have done it, and I'm going to do it. But just to make things easier, I'm going to say I did do it. And then, of course, we forget about it all, entirely and never do it. And we get in a whole ton of trouble. But anyway, that was my sort of thinking on it. He's not really a bad guy, but he's also not a perfect person. And maybe he... sort of goes is a little bit he shouldn't he obviously shouldn't have done that if you really want to get technical about it, but so it goes. This final scene here, I really wanted to sort of tie up the stuff where it's like, okay, Slipstream Phoenix has showed up, There's all these aspects to his personality. Jenny McCambridge was not part of the meeting where they really talked about why Slipstream Phoenix is there, you know, why the commissioner is there and all that stuff. So she's just presumably found out about all this stuff elsewhere and goes out to confront him. I really wanted to sort of get into her personality a little bit too. You know, she talks about, well, I'm, you know, there's seven of me, so people have never given me a partner before, and I'm really excited. And I always kind of like the idea that, I always like giving, you know, people in these sort of crazy, superhero worlds personalities that have been, you know, they're probably a person just like anybody you know, but then but their perceptions and their personalities have to be warped just a little bit by a difference in perception. Say if she has seven selves and she can see things from seven perspectives, and there's people, you know, and she can be a crowd of people if she wants to, it's got to sort of affect her in a certain way. Not make her, you know, the easy thing is to make people go crazy or something like that, but I really kind of like the idea that she just sort of have a different perspective on things. And in this case, I kind of like that she's, she kind of likes to depend on herself and doesn't really, and has a hard time sort of letting other people in. It also makes her fairly relatable. I mean, we all know people like that. The final scene, one of the things that's funny about working in layouts, as opposed to a script can be sort of like knocked out without a whole lot of effort. And of course it can be adjusted for length. You know, if you find, oh, I'm running out of space, you can just sort of say, all right, well, I'm going to eliminate a couple panels here and I'm going to move this here. And you really haven't wasted that much work. But I was doing this all in layouts. Like I was really just sort of saying, all right, page one, upper left-hand corner, bang, here's the panel. And while that has its advantages and disadvantages. One of the disadvantages is that if you screw up, you know, your page estimations, how long you think a scene is going to take, and you run out of space, well, I wouldn't say you're screwed, but you're put in a position where it takes a tremendous amount of work to get yourself out of that, and you may find yourself wasting a lot of time with it, And so it was really quite lucky that it worked out this way. Where, you know, it's nice to sort of say like, oh well, even if nothing else, you can kind of go for the 9-panel grid, and that you can just pack a ton of stuff in there, and then bang, you know, and finish it all up. One of the advantages to working that way is, for me, it's like it very much sort of being there, being part of the flow of how people will read it, and being able to draw, you know, sort of sketch 3 panels and write out the dialogue, and then you can immediately go back and read it as a comic, like as it really will be read. And that's, I think, a really valuable thing. Because when you write a script, it's like, well, you can reread that script, but you're not having the same experience that someone reading a comic is going to have, and you never really know how it's going to turn out. And while there are variables in how a comic's going to turn out when you do layouts and someone else does finished artwork, you generally know, like, okay, this is going to work as a comic, or it's not going to work as a comic. And you could try something that you think, oh, I don't know if this will work, and then you can find out if it'll work instead of, you know, doing something and then having, you know, really kind of putting an artist in a bad position by giving them a script that isn't going to work. You know, you need to pay, when you're giving someone a script and having them execute it well, sometimes you need to play it a little bit safe, so that they know what's expected. In any case, working in this sort of way, where, you know, kind of where the rubber meets the road, was useful in that, like, there are a lot of plot elements that just sort of popped into being because it's like, well, let's just add like a little extra comment here. And it's like, oh, well, that adds another little layer of personality to this person. And so maybe we'll add that as a sub plot. It can be kind of fun in that way. But anyway, like I said, it also, you run great risks of running out of space and then having to do a great deal of work to get around it. This final page, you know, I really wanted to sort of epitomize all of the unpleasantness that people feel about Slipstream Phoenix being what they think of as a spy or or someone who's sort of on board with this new regime, and really start saying like, okay, well then what do you believe in? And I mean, I think it's fairly transparent, but you can just sort of say like, all right, well let's have this character actually almost speak to the camera and say, you know what, this is what I believe in. This is why I'm the way I am. Without trying to justify anything bad, just saying like, this is why I need to do everything right. And, in so doing, he gets Jenny McCambridge on his side, which is nice, because in the next issue, everyone else, not everyone, but a lot of people don't really care for him, and it's nice to have at least one person who says, yeah, he's all right. So that takes us to the end, with the classic panning out shot. Hope you've enjoyed this podcast. It's kind of interesting to look back on work that you've done, and I think it's really a lot of fun to talk about the techniques involved. If you have any questions about this, or if you want to have a discussion, you can always write to me at xander@bigtimeaddict.com, BIGTIMEATTIC. And thank you very much.